questioning the One China policy is something that really cuts down very deep for the Chinese.
Controversial moves from the White House spark confusion and protests. It's Monday, January 28th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Welcome, and get the full program experience by logging on to our Facebook page at VOA Asia. Also ahead, one U.S.-China flashpoint is in the South China Sea. India's massive information technology sector may be affected by tighter U.S. rules. The student credit crunch and celebrating the Lunar New Year. It's all right now on VOA Asia. The White House is defending President Donald Trump's executive order limiting U.S. immigration from seven Muslim-majority countries, despite widespread protests and a U.S. federal court ruling halting the move. The executive order issued Friday has led to massive confusion as refugees, green card holders, students, and workers were detained at American airports or barred from boarding international flights to the United States. The controversial U.S. ban currently applies to Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. On Sunday, White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus hinted that Pakistan could be included. Pakistan's leading opposition politician Imran Khan urged educated and skilled Pakistani youth to abandon U.S. travel plans in search of better economic futures and to focus instead on building Pakistan. Meanwhile, more controversy continues to bubble over China. Rex Tillerson, President-elect Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of State, suggested in his confirmation hearing that the United States might change its course in the South China Sea by blocking Beijing's access to its man-made islands. Plus, Trump has questioned maintaining the One China policy. VOA Asia's Steve Miller speaks via Skype with VOA Beijing Bureau Chief Bill Ide.
State media has been really giving the strongest responses to these policy measures that have been put forward by Trump and also by Secretary of State nominee Tillerson. And they've been, the more extreme comments have been to the point that they're saying that if the United States wants to, if the incoming administration wants to change the One China policy, wants to question it, and if this continues, or if the policies that Tillerson has suggested regarding the South China Sea are put into place, that they should be prepared for some kind of a military conflict. So they should be prepared to wage war.
As those conversations drifted down to the street level, because during the election, a lot of Chinese people said that they respected Donald Trump because of his amassed wealth and they admired him for his business acumen. But what are they saying now?
Yeah, there's a huge contrast between what we hear in state media and what goes on in people's day-to-day lives. There is a perception among analysts that really these issues are not that important. They don't really are things that people are concerned about. They're more concerned about pay and jobs. But for sure, people do have a different perception of Donald Trump now than they did, say, a month or so ago. There were many, I think, Chinese officials who felt that Donald Trump was probably the better choice out of the two because they had seen how Hillary Clinton had taken on China in the past. But now I think what they've gotten is perhaps Hillary Clinton on steroids. There's just, he is so much more aggressive. Obviously, there are questions about how far he'll go with trade policies or with South China Sea. But if he takes those even to like a half of what he's said, there's going to be some huge changes and China's going to have to respond because it's already made it clear that it will respond and that it takes these suggested changes very seriously.
Some analysts and even his supporters say that perhaps you're focusing too heavily on the exact words that President Trump is tweeting, that perhaps it's better to look at his comments with a broader stroke. Is that kind of conversation taking place in China?
Not really. I think at this point, there's a lot of shock and awe about, the things that he's had to say. Questioning the One China policy is something that really cuts down very deep for the Chinese. It hits a nerve, and it's something that they feel very strongly about. There is a sense that here that, okay, he's a businessman, he's a business negotiator, These are negotiating tactics. There is a bit of a hope that this is all part of a negotiation. You know, it's part of the way he handles things in the boardroom. Maybe this is part of a show. It's an act. I think there's a hope that that's the case. But some of the measures and changes that he's laid out are ones that seriously question policies and positions that China has long held, be it the South China Sea or Taiwan, that some say in the United States are a facade, claiming that almost all of the South China Sea is part of China's territory, or that a democratically ruled island that elects its own officials is part of China. Obviously, there's a history and it's very complex, but there are those that feel that that reality should be questioned, and for the first time, it is being. And China does not know really what to do at this point.
Follow more with us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and on the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Survivors found from tourist boat missing off Borneo. International anger erupts over Trump's order banning refugees from the United States. Indonesia breaks silence on refugees with presidential decree. 4 abducted Pakistani rights activists return home. Lunar New Year fireworks push Beijing smog to dangerous levels. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. Thanks for spending some time with us today on VOA Asia. Fledgling relations between maritime sovereignty rivals China and the Philippines face another test this year, with new friction over Beijing's island reclamation in disputed waters, and new U.S. President Donald Trump's expected challenge to Chinese clout in Asia. The flap with China, plus a new overture from the United States, will challenge Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte to play one power off the other without isolating either or giving up maritime claims. Duterte has set aside years of friction with Beijing and met with Chinese President Xi Jinping in October. But 2 months later, his government filed a mild protest to Beijing over island building in the contested Spratly Islands. Douglas Guilfoyle is Associate International Law Professor at Monash University in Australia.
It kind of underlines the fact that the Spratly Islands are a serious national interest issue for the Philippines, and that despite the element of friendly relations after the Duterte visit to Beijing, it doesn't seem as simple as just the issue has been traded off against better Chinese relations and that China can anticipate getting everything it wanted. After all,
China holds 7 Spratly features compared to 9 under Philippine control. Much of the chain lies in a Philippine exclusive economic zone. The sea is rich in fisheries and may have extensive reserves of undersea fossil fuel. Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, and Vietnam also claim all or parts of it. Herman Kraft, political scientist at the University of the Philippines Diliman, says Beijing has used private talks and pledges of aid or investment to build relations with other smaller countries in Asia.
I suspect that from the perspective of the Chinese, this is something that requires consultation and not unilateral action. The protest that was actually filed is probably something that might have caught the Chinese by surprise a bit. As long as it's not multilateralized, I think the Chinese are actually willing to accept it.
President Trump's nominee for Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, advocated that China be stopped from occupying more disputed islets in the sea. Carl Thayer, Emeritus Professor of Politics at the University of New South Wales in Australia, says China may have built military installations in the Spratlys as preparation for Trump's presidency. But he says Duterte probably would not let Trump position troops in the Philippines to resist China.
The longer term is quite different. The buildup of the U.S. military is going to take years. So it's not going to happen immediately. And it seems clear to me that Trump is really after market access and a resolution of the so-called currency manipulation issue with China.
The U.S. government is a long-standing counterweight to Chinese military power in Asia and recently an ally of smaller Asian countries faced with Beijing's maritime expansion. Washington seeks to protect marine shipping lanes and a network of pro-U.S. Asia-Pacific allies. There's still more to come on VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, a leading lawyer and advisor to Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy Party has been killed in Myanmar. Kony was shot in the head, his taxi driver also shot. A suspect has been detained. There are no details on motive. Assassinations are extremely rare in Myanmar. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. There is growing concern that India's $150 billion information technology industry, which relies heavily on exports to the United States, could slow down and become less competitive if the Trump administration tightens rules on hiring skilled foreign workers. Earlier this month, a bill was introduced in the U.S. Congress raising the minimum salary for positions granted under the H-1B visa from $60,000 to $100,000 per year. Indian IT companies, which send hundreds of Indian tech professionals to the United States, are among the biggest beneficiaries of the H-1B visa program, which allows foreign professionals to work in the United States. Madhu Babu studies the tech sector at the brokerage firm Prabhudas Liladhar in Mumbai.
So H-1 is a very important lifeline for the sector. Now if there is a tougher stand on the visas, which is more likely to be, so companies would have to substantially increase the local hiring.
Sponsors of the bill say it is designed to close loopholes in the high-skilled immigration system used by some companies to import cheap foreign workers. In recent decades, Indian software firms emerged on the front lines of the global outsourcing industry by using the country's large pool of trained, low-cost engineers to beat the competition. But this core business model is under threat if immigration and visa policies turn restrictive in major markets such as the United States. Indian software companies have long maintained they use Indian employees because of a shortage of skilled workers in the United States. Critics say the lower cost of Indian hires has displaced American IT workers. Experts like Madhu Babu say the slowdown is likely to be sharper in the coming year, especially for companies that have about half their employees in the United States working with H-1B visas.
You will hire more locally and you will pay higher salaries on site and all that. And so next 1.5 year earning growth will also be tough for the sector.
Shivrendra Singh, the chief of global trade development for the National Association for Software and Services Companies, points out that the Indian industry has been a net creator of jobs.
We created about, supported more than 411,000 jobs in the U.S., whether it's, $20 billion of taxes that have been paid by our companies in a period of 4 years. So that is something which the whole objective is to highlight this.
The looming threat of visa curbs in the United States comes at a time when the sector is grappling with another challenge. New technologies, such as cloud computing and analytics, that could reduce the demand for traditional IT work by an estimated 30 to 40%. The outsourcing industry accounts for about 20% of India's exports of goods and services and has helped to catapult millions of Indians into the middle class. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. After pouring more than $5 billion into India over the past 3 years, a series of missteps threatens to hurt online giant Amazon in one of the world's fastest-growing markets. Amazon apologized for selling a doormat bearing the Indian flag and flip-flops with the image of iconic freedom fighter Mahatma Gandhi. All the big stories coming your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. With more than 1 million international students studying to get a university degree in the United States, one of the challenges they face is getting approval to obtain a credit card. Banks and other lenders approve credit card requests based upon a person's credit history, something a foreign student may have difficulty providing. But now there are lenders that cater to international students by looking at alternative metrics to determine a person's credit worthiness. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports on one Silicon Valley lender with immigrant roots.
After leaving Beijing to study in the United States, Jack Guo has learned to navigate a new language, different methods of getting around, and even a new way of managing his money. That means getting a credit card.
A lot of my friends who have had the cards already, because it's pretty important to get around on LA. And also, if you are going to stay here afterwards for job, for internship, for career, you know, of course, you are going to consider to buying a property to live here. And having a credit is pretty important. You want to get a loan.
Unlike many cash-based societies, credit cards are widely used in the United States, especially with the advent of e-commerce, where users with a credit card and a smartphone can buy items and order food or a car ride. But getting an American credit card as an international student is not easy. Traditional U.S. lenders ask for the social security number of applicants and look at their credit history, things most international students don't have.
The traditional system was designed in 20th century before internet, before smartphone, before social media, and it's kind of antiquated. We are inventing a new system.
Kalpesh Kapadia, a former student from India, is the co-founder of CellScore, a lender that issues credit cards to students from abroad.
They have to prove their financial wherewithal to study. And when they come here, they are treated as if they are invisible from the credit system standpoint.
Based in Silicon Valley, CellScore looks at a different kind of data to determine a person's credit worthiness.
Everyone has a smartphone, everyone has a social media presence. So what we look at is that these people have been through many filters in the society.
For filters, CellScore looks at documents presented by the applicant, including acceptance to a school, passport, visa, and ability to pay. Kapadia said fewer than 1% of CellScore's 10,000 credit card holders are delinquent on payments.
This is a highly motivated population. Someone who comes here 10,000 miles away to make their life better through education is going to behave quite differently.
The 15 to 20% who don't pay their total monthly balances are charged high interest, about 19%. So far, students from more than 66 countries and attending 400 colleges in the U.S. have a CellScore credit card. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Palo Alto, California.
Developing at this hour in Asia, Hong Kong is returning 9 armored troop carriers to Singapore impounded since November. They were seized by customs officials on the way back from training exercises in Taiwan. Local media suggests the diplomatic dispute had emanated from pressure by Beijing. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, it's official. We're now in the year of the rooster. And for many of you, the Lunar New Year festivities continue. So we continue speaking now with our VOA Asian correspondents about their celebrations and traditions. Since it's commonly referred to as Chinese New Year, today, Mandarin reporter Lin Yang joins us.
Chinese New Year is the most important festival for us, for Chinese people, and a lot of people, I guess, in Asia as well. It's actually a really long celebration, start from the day before the Lunar New Year mm-hmm. and run until the 15th. It's all considered our celebration. So it's a very long celebration. And the first thing you have to do basically is you have to thoroughly clean your house. And that's in order to sweep away any ill fortune or make way for very good incoming luck. Mm-hmm. And then my favorite part, that's the 年夜饭. It's the reunion dinner, and we call it 年夜饭 in Chinese. It's like Thanksgiving here.
Oh, sure.
So all the family members get together. We'll have this feast. If you know Chinese food, you know Chinese feast is like great.
Yes.
And then we'll have dishes of meat, like tons and tons of meat. I think chicken, pork, and fish is absolutely necessary. And then they're just... Normally, I would see 20 to 30 dishes
wow.
on our table, and it's spread everywhere. People stand and eat and then chat with each other.
That's why it needs to be about 2 weeks long. There's so much food.
I guess. There's a lot of leftovers after that day. I'm from Beijing. Mm-hmm. So in the northern part of China, basically, we like to eat dumplings.
Oh, yes.
When at midnight. And we will wrap a little coin in one of the dumplings. And then someone, if you got it, it means you have good fortune and good luck the next year.
Wow.
So everyone fights for it. We're trying to pick and find.
Find it find in there. It. Yeah, well, you don't want to eat it.
We try to. No, you don't want to eat it, but you want to pick it out and then show it to everybody.
Yes, that's the prize.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really nice. And then another thing I really like is, of course, the red envelope. So that's usually parents will give it to kids. And then now I'm married, so I can't get it anymore. Oh. But up until you're married, you can still get it. So
okay, well, maybe your spouse could give you a red envelope. How's that?
There you go.
Start a new tradition.
And then it runs until the 15th, which is called Yuanxiao Festival. So it's Lantern Festival. People will write their wishes on a lantern, and then they will set it free to, you know, wish for good luck for the next year.
Yeah. You're not in Beijing this year. So what do you do here? How does the tradition change, or how does it remain the same here?
I think we try to keep, you know, at least the spirit. On the first day of, you know, the new year, I'm definitely going to keep the tradition to wear red, to wear new clothes, to welcome the new year. And then my family, friend, and everybody will gather together and have a feast together. So it will be happy, and it will be, you know, welcome the year of the rooster.
We wish you and your family all the best in the new year, the year of the rooster. Lin Yang, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we hope your new year is going well so far. Well, you've started it by listening to VOA Asia. That's a good start. We appreciate you joining us today. Our thanks go to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Nelson Lopes, Managing Editor Diane Gao, and of course our VOA Asia team, Steve Miller, Ali Ogden, Eli Zimmerman. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead and invite you to come back for another edition of VOA Asia tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From time to time, the United States identifies certain individuals as crucial to the operation of terrorist organizations. Often, these individuals are top leaders, or they help finance terrorist organizations. These are frequently people who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. When such individuals are identified, the U.S. government places that person's name on the specially designated nationals list. Their assets within U.S. reach are immediately blocked, and they are effectively locked out of the global financial system. As a result, no U.S. citizen or company may conduct business with designated individuals. In this way, the United States deters participation in terrorism and disrupts financial support networks for terrorists and terrorist organizations. Such are the cases of Ali Damush and Mustafa Mughniyeh. Both men, top leaders of the Lebanon-based Hezbollah terrorist organization, have recently been named by the United States Department of State as specially designated global terrorists under Executive Order 13224. Ali Damush is the head of Hezbollah's Foreign Relations Department, an organization that engages in covert terrorist operations around the world on behalf of Hezbollah and includes recruiting operatives and gathering intelligence. Mustafa Mughniyeh is a Hezbollah commander who once led Hezbollah's operation in the Golan Heights and helped organize the group's terrorist infrastructure. He is the nephew of former Hezbollah military commander Mustafa Badreddin and the son of Imad Mughniyeh, the former chief of Hezbollah military and terrorist operations. The imposition of sanctions by the United States against terrorists like Damush and Mughniyeh notifies the American public and the international community that Ali Damush and Mustafa Mughniyeh are actively engaged in terrorism. Such designations of terrorist individuals and groups expose and isolate organizations and individuals and assist or complement the law enforcement actions of U.S. agencies as well as those of other governments.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.